You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected work by Rudolf Steiner, number 313, entitled Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 14th of April, 1921. Yesterday I said that certain syndromes are encompassed in the phenomena of falling asleep and waking up. Initially, it is of primary importance to consider the symptoms comprised in the process of falling asleep. And here the following must be stated. Difficulties in falling asleep always indicate that the astral body, I will use this term here since you are now all very familiar with it, clings to the physical and etheric organs, especially the latter, and is too strongly connected to them. A spiritual investigator can easily detect how the astral body clings on in this way by the fact that the organs, both physical and others, continue to function as they do during waking life, whereas in normal conditions of falling asleep, they undergo a marked decline in activity. I said yesterday that it is very difficult, of course, to properly assess the full scope and significance of such sleep-related phenomena. We, therefore, need to acquire a comprehensive view, as it were, of the phenomena which, in a waking state, are concomitant with difficulties in falling asleep. We find such concomitant behavior in all that, in a certain way, points to involuntary function of the organism. In other words, any involuntary twitching of the lips or blinking of the eyelids, any excessive movement of the fingers and such like, anything, in fact, that does not give expression to an inner process, and thus all sorts of fidgeting, is indicative in waking life of a reduced capacity to fall asleep. Naturally, we can mostly only detect this process when it is clearly apparent externally. When such twitching occurs in relation to our internal organs, we will need to acquire certain skill in detecting it and learn how to properly connect certain symptoms. For instance, one can detect certain noises in patients suffering from chlorosis in the blood vessels descending on the left and right side of the neck and further down. Such noises, formerly called, quote, venous hum, close quote, parenthesis, I am not sure if this is still the term used for them, close parenthesis, can be detected in all of us if we turn the head abruptly to the left or right. When, in other words, we initiate a strong development of astrality, which always occurs if we carry out involuntarily a movement usually otherwise voluntary. Astrality is exerted too strongly, used too strongly, pushed too strongly toward an organ every time that a movement usually carried out voluntarily, thus a movement dependent on the eye, capital, becomes involuntary and thereby acquires a twitchy quality. By indirect observations of this kind, we can learn to detect twitching in the inner organs. Problems falling asleep always indicate an irregularity somewhat inaccessible to direct external medical interventions. This irregularity is far removed from phenomena I described yesterday in relation to such things as light and magnetic and electrical fields. All that is concomitant with difficulty in falling asleep is somewhat removed from such phenomena. And here, therefore, we must resort to medicines. Thus, if we find a syndrome that can be summarized as, quote, problems in falling asleep, close quote, medicines will be needed, specifically ones involving processes induced by cooking or combusting vegetable substances. Where we find problems in falling asleep and disorders of the human thorax, and thus a condition involving the astral body's over-adherence to physical and etheric organs, all medicines obtained by decocting roots and by ashing or combustion will be of great importance. All the strength concentrated in a root decoction and plant ash will play an especially important role here. On the other hand, everything I described yesterday will be of most significance where there is a difficulty in waking up. Poor capacity to wake from sleep always indicates that the astral body is engaging too little with the organs. In chest disorders, this reduced engagement of the astral body has a somewhat different significance compared with general illnesses of the human organism. In the latter case, one has to try to induce the whole astral body to enter more strongly. Then, what I said a few days ago about the effects of arsenic comes into its own. This is only effective, though, when it is a matter of treating an astral body already permeated by the I capital. If one needs to treat the astral body alone, in contrast, it will be of particular importance to resort to the kinds of measure I described yesterday. Difficulty in waking up is always accompanied by symptoms one can describe as a dazed state or a tendency for consciousness to remain dulled. In other words, the symptoms accompanying difficulties in waking up after sleep are largely mental or psychological ones. For those patients, therefore, who show any impairment of their chest organism, and who at the same time manifest accompanying psychological symptoms of this kind, it will be very important to use cures involving magnetic or electrical fields, as I described. Here, though, I would like to note the following in response to a question I was asked yesterday. Parenthesis, as far as time allows, I will try to respond to all questions put to me during these lectures. Close parenthesis. The question related to the difference between treatment with direct current and alternating current. If a patient is clearly in a frail condition, suffering, for example, from malnutrition and so forth, so that the disorder proceeds more from what I will call the lower part of the middle organism, it is better to use alternating current. If, on the other hand, it is clear that a disorder proceeds from the upper organism, it will be better to use direct current. However, the difference is not very great, and you will not go far wrong by using either. You will have gathered that precisely in this area of human health and illness, one also finds important points of reference for general dietary measures. A subtle transition exists here between effects of a more dynamic nature, externally applied, and those arising from plant substances we first process and transform ourselves. But you will understand that because we are considering the region in us where everything relies on rhythm, on rhythmic functioning in the human organism, something else also arises here, which is essential to consider when assessing health and sickness, that our approach must avoid fanaticism of all kinds. The kind of fanaticism which can come to expression, say, in extreme forms of raw food diets, applied fanatically as a dietary prescription, will have a very specific consequence for the whole human organism. Raw food, in other words, never eating in cooked form the parts of a plant that are lower down, toward the root, means that the health of the respiratory system is gradually undermined. The human organism isn't easily wrecked, and so the ruinous effects of a fanaticism of this kind will not become apparent for a long time. Gradually, though, an extreme raw food diet will express itself in marked shortness of breath or similar conditions. Yet someone might come along and object that they had excellent results with a fruit diet. Then the following must be said. Fruits are not roots, but are strongly exposed to external sun. Here a pronounced extraterrestrial process is accomplished that comes very close to cooking and draws on the dynamic potential in fruit. Thus, if certain patients are given fresh fruit, specifically not roots, this will do a great deal less harm than letting them eat uncooked roots. We must not be fanatical in either direction, but instead find an individualized approach that can go both ways. There may very well be cases where it becomes clearly apparent that the irregularity in a person's chest system originates in his circulation and not in the respiratory rhythm. If I can be sure that the disorder originates in the circulation and not the respiratory rhythm, I will need to turn to something that plays over from the digestive functions into the circulatory functions. And here I will make up for what is lacking by giving a diet of raw fruit. That will be absolutely right. In such a case, one can certainly resort to a raw fruit diet. But if impairment of chest function tends to originate in a patient's breathing, such treatment will achieve nothing and may even be harmful. Here, instead, I will need to provide a diet of cooked roots. The instability of fluctuating dynamics in this system shows clearly how misplaced any particular form of fanaticism is. Now, we will not gain a full understanding of this system, and will therefore have to cover the same ground again, if we do not take account in this first part of our course, which focuses more on pathology, whereas the second part will focus more on therapy, of a process in the human organism that is very often entirely inaccessible to external observation, and whose deleterious effect on human health therefore remains unobserved. In my general lectures, in speaking of philology, though this theme could equally well have figured in the section on science, I spoke of remarkable processes that discharge outward from the organism at puberty, whereas they discharge inward in the period between birth and the change of teeth, when a child is learning to talk, therefore. The processes that occur here, between the human astral body and etheric body, and also the physical body, underlie the acquisition of speech in a child, and all the changes in the human organism connected with this. We should therefore observe these processes very carefully in a child. As he learns to talk, this always goes hand in hand with changes in the rest of the organism. And as I said, we ought also to trace back these changes in reverse toward birth. In other words, looking back from the radical reconfiguration at second dentition to the time when the child was learning to talk. But now we find an equally important change that is more inward directed and is not so outwardly apparent as, for instance, second dentition, which anyone will notice, or learning to speak. We will, likewise, all be aware of the child's developing speech, which manifests outwardly. This other change is almost more important for health and illness than the others, which, as I said, are palpable and apparent and therefore engage what I will call our instinctive educational actions. A much greater significance underlies this other, more hidden process, which occurs in the period between the change of teeth and puberty, right in the middle of this period. Here, the true I, which is really only exoterically born, as I have said elsewhere, born in a fully exoteric way around the age of 20, is born into the child, just as the astral body is born in the acquisition of speech. This process culminates between the age of 8 and 9. And now, please consider the following. Our I-related predisposition, the I-capacity in us, is scarcely ever taken into account. Indwelling the human organism, the I does something very particular. Everything else in us, our physical attributes, which we will certainly return to in detail, our etheric and also astral level of existence, which really only enters into connection with the outside world through oxygen, are aspects of our being that are very strongly connected to our interior. Almost alone amongst the aspects of the human organism, the astral body is withdrawn from us in sleep by the I. The astral body has a very strong affinity with the physical body, and even more so with the etheric body. But this is not true of the I. And here, notably in the relationship and connection of the I with the outer world, we see the profound difference between the human being and the animal. When we ingest food, we absorb substances that are also external substances and must be transformed within us. Who causes this transformation? This thorough transformation of outer substances within us. Who does this? In truth, it is the I. The I alone has the power of, as it were, extending its feelers down into the forces of external substances. See plate 4 top. If you have an external substance, I'll draw it schematically like this. It has certain forces that have to be separated out if they are to be recombined in the human organism. Etheric body and astral body, in a certain sense, tiptoe round the substances and do not have the strength to penetrate their inner nature. They just circle round them. Only the I really engages in penetrating the substances themselves and delving into them. So when you offer a food substance to the human organism, this food is first inside us. The I, however, reaches beyond the whole human organism and directly enters the food substance. Thus a reciprocal action arises between the inner forces of the food substance and the human I. Here the outer world in respect of chemistry and physics, and the internal world of the human being in respect of anti-chemistry and anti-physics, extend into each other. That is the important thing. Up to the time when the second teeth begin to develop, thus the beginnings of second dentition, this engagement with food substances is governed from the head. The child has been constituted during fetal development so that at birth he has received forces via his head that are active in assimilating substances from within. But after second dentition, in the time leading up to puberty and culminating between the 9th and 10th year, the I that works from our lower organism, the lower I, has to meet and engage with the upper I. In children, the I always acts from the upper organism to assimilate substances until the age referred to. I mean, of course, the instruments of the I. The I itself is ultimately a unified entity, but the I's instruments, the polarity of I activity expressed in the lower I, which meets the upper I, only establish a proper mutual relationship at this age between the 9th and 10th year. The I has to enter the human organization in the same way as the astral body must engage with the human organization when a child learns to speak. With these considerations in mind, let us now observe everything that becomes apparent in children from the 8th or 9th year onward through to the age of 11 or 12, aspects that are so important to take account of in children's schooling at this age. Starting from the perspective I have outlined, we will find the outer expression of these phenomena in a search in which the human organism is engaged. which involves searching for a harmony established only during the course of life between assimilated substances and our inner organization. Try to observe carefully how the head at this age does not much want to assimilate substances' inner forces, how it objects to this, and how this comes to expression in headaches around the 9th, 10th, or 11th year. Then, observe how concomitant conditions arise in metabolic disorders, ones that manifest relatively close to the exterior in the secretion of gastric acid and so forth. If you observe all these things, you can see how some children are continually ailing, in a sense due to this lack of adjustment between the eye acting from below and from above. If we pay careful attention to such things, we can remedy them. And after puberty, they will normally fade and vanish. For at this age, the astral body catches up and can compensate for what the eye is not able to accomplish. These things gradually diminish from the 14th or 15th year through to the 20th or 21st. Children ailing at this period between second dentition and puberty can later become extraordinarily healthy, and it is very instructive to observe this. You will often have seen how ailing children, especially those in whom this sickliness expresses itself in digestive disorders, in irregular digestion, later go on to flourish and be fully healthy when carefully treated. It is very important that such treatment should take great care in relation to dietary prescriptions. Wonderful things can be achieved as long as the parents or teachers of children with this kind of ailment refrain from continually offering large amounts of food which they try to persuade them to eat. This will continually exacerbate the condition. Instead, we should try to discover what the child can easily digest, what he can assimilate especially well. And then we should serve this to him in smaller, more frequent portions, thus distributing food intake over a larger number of meals. This will do these children a great deal of good. It is quite mistaken to think we are achieving anything by overfeeding, persuasion, and such like. If, in addition, we ensure that such children are not too overburdened by schoolwork, which will increasingly exacerbate their condition, but instead give them enough rest and leisure, we will also be enhancing the inwardly necessary digestive activity achieved by offering smaller portions of food. The very opposite of this is done on a large scale, and by overlooking or transgressing this law, we do not nurture healthy human development. Instead, all sorts of predispositions for illness potentially result from these digestive ailments and can continue to affect a person for the rest of his life.
In the Waldorf school, people are quick to complain that we give children so little homework. There are good reasons for this. An educational approach in tune with reality does not just uphold abstract principles or the general abstractions often proposed today, but instead takes account of everything that needs to inform a person's actual development. Above all, this includes not overburdening children with homework, which can sometimes, certainly, be the deeply concealed cause of poor digestion. Such things always only manifest later in life, but they are real factors. Remarkably, supersensible insight into human development can show us how conditions that only come to the fore later in life are already apparent in hints and signs at an earlier age. A danger lies in what I will call the engagement or coupling of the lower eye with the human organism. It exists really for all people and poses a particular risk for children in modern civilization. Anyone not of sturdy peasant stock should be aware of this risk. A strong distinction still exists in relation to such things, and must be made here. between people of peasant or farming stock and the rest of us. All the rest of the world's population has a very marked predisposition to risks arising from this insufficient engagement of the I with the organism, which is thoroughly ruined before this I is due to engage it. Such risks appear as the I engages from below, in the respiratory system and also the head system. The female constitution is more susceptible to this remarkably unstable balance. Men are more robust, though not more stable, in relation to their chest organization, and therefore less sensitive or susceptible. While the same problems can affect them, these are likely to be less apparent. The female sex is more sensitive to everything that occurs here, and what I have described as the search for the right kind of engagement or coupling of the eye either culminates in a healthy condition or in anemia. Anemia is the direct continuation of all abnormal occurrences of this kind after the age of 7. It only surfaces later as a disorder, but represents an intensification of factors that are present but unnoticeable at an earlier stage of life. Here we must make an extremely important distinction. In considering the circulatory system, we must distinguish circulation itself as a sum of motions from what in turn intimately informs this circulation and, as it were, penetrates it, which is metabolism. The circulatory system is informed by an equilibrium between the metabolic system and the rhythmic system, whereas the respiratory system reveals an equilibrium between the rhythmic organism and the organism of nerves and senses. Observing this middle realm of the human organism, the chest system, we have to remember that it is organized between two polarities. Through breathing, it is organizationally related to the head, and through circulation, to the system of metabolism and limbs. Everything in the metabolism itself, or in what intimately accompanies the metabolism as our capacity for movement, which is of great importance, especially in the first or rising half of life, pushes its way into the circulatory forces as forces of metabolism. And this upward pushing dynamic must in turn advance, so that in the process I described, we find that what the I brings about in metabolism, and also in the assimilation of substances, advances into strong engagement with the substance's inner forces. We find here an upward migration through circulation and breathing that extends as far as the head system. And this has to organize itself properly in the period I spoke of between second dentition and sexual maturity. The eye's capacity to grasp hold of, to engage with the forces of external substances, must migrate upward through circulation and breathing until it acts properly upon the head system. This is the very complex process we have to study, and we can really only do so by trying to understand its effect in what I would call the outer digestive tract, where substances still strongly resemble the form they have in the outer world, and where our inner processes have as yet taken only a weak hold of them. What is this first engagement with external substances in fact? What is the eye doing when it first grasps hold of external substance? When the eye first grasps the forces of external substances, this is accompanied by taste sensations. Taste, the assimilation of outer substances in the subjective experience of tasting. This is the first engagement of our inner forces. Then the process works its way inward. But tasting also extends inward. The inner digestive organism in other words, on the other side of the intestine, leading over into the blood, is still an attenuated tasting. And really, this continues upward until tasting is countered in the head. Here, tasting is deadened. The head opposes and deadens the process of tasting, which must, though, first fully unfold. The eye naturally takes stronger hold of substances, penetrates them more deeply than is the case in mere outward subjective tasting. What occurs, in a sense, in the external digestive tract is strongly influenced by the mineral or salt element. Every aspect of what I am saying now accords with my expositions in the previous course, and, as you will see, mostly extends and enlarges on it. The fact of the matter is as follows. A basic and essential question in medicine is to ask what a medicament actually is. What is a medicine, derived as it is from the outer realm of nature? Whatever the organism can digest when healthy is not a medicine. This cannot be a medicine. We can only start to speak of a medicine when we administer something to the organism which it cannot digest when healthy, which must therefore only be assimilated in an abnormal human organism. We challenge the abnormal human organism to assimilate something that is not assimilated in a healthy human organism. Healing is therefore a continuation of digestion, but digestion, in fact, which is gradually transposed into the interior of the human organism. The most palpable and fully developed forms of, say, anemia, are accompanied by the following concomitant symptoms: tiredness, lethargy, difficulty in falling asleep, or in waking up. Given all these symptoms, which can affect most children between second dentition and puberty, we first have to try to remedy the condition in the external digestive tract. Here we have to use mineral substance, still entirely mineral in character. And we will find this to be beneficial. Initially, these things may be observed as symptoms, strong symptoms, which all indicate how the eye is seeking to grasp hold outwardly of the forces of external substances, and how it can be supported in this endeavor by, say, carbonated iron. Iron carbonate is something that supports the organism in combating lethargy whenever the eye needs to get an outward grip. If we take this a stage further, we find the eye intervening too weakly in the circulatory organism. Then we will see how the eye's lack of engagement in the circulatory organism can, for example, be supported by ferrum muriaticum, thus by a medicine enhanced and intensified in the purely mineral realm. If we continue to the respiratory organism, thus advancing another stage higher, we can give very particular support to the eye by using vegetable acid. Rising further to the head system, we can do this with the pure metals, not, of course, as pure metals in an external sense, for initially these have no proper relationship to the human organism, but instead in their subtlest powers. This is why I said last year that basically the human organism won't let you muck about with it by using metals allopathically, for it is itself a homeopath. In the ascent from the digestive system to the head organism, it fragments the metals itself. And we can, of course, support the organism in this process by potentizing a substance. But you will find, and we will return to this later and look at it from a different angle, that we can learn something here about potentization. We have to ascertain the actual locus of the deficiency. The lower and further away from the head the deficiency or lack of engagement is centered in the human organism, the lower should be the potencies we use. The nearer we find it to be to the head organization, the higher are the potencies required. It is, of course, the case that what comes too close to the head organization can express itself in all sorts of ways. How the I grasps hold of the external world is a real point of departure, which will enable us to fathom the symptomatic phenomena we encounter. If you reflect on the things we have been discussing over the past few days, you will recall my emphasis on a view of the human organism that cannot be encompassed in terms of shapes and outlines, for these only represent solid tissue. The human organism is largely also organized fluid, organized air, and organized temperature. And now, you see, the I has to engage and grasp hold of these different aspects of the organism. Especially important and subtle in nature is the engagement of the I in the body's different temperature conditions. The I has to engage in these temperature variations within the body in the following way. At birth, we have an image of the I. The image or imprint of the I is present in the head, as stated previously. The I is present there as image and works throughout childhood. And now, alongside this, the I must, as it were, give reality or existence from below, must engage in the organism. This is expressed in the fact that this image of the I we have in our head permeates our organism with warmth in childhood, is connected with the warming of the human organism. However, this permeation with warmth fades. It is strongest at birth insofar as the warming process issues from the head and then falls away. See Plate 4. And later on in life, we need to maintain at a peak from below the warmth that develops in this way, and to do so through the engagement of the I in these temperature conditions. As we grow older, we have to oppose this lapsing graph of warmth with the other rising one, which largely depends on a capacity to grasp hold of rising forces made available from food substance and to lead these into circulation, breathing, and the head system. Now let us assume that this does not happen in the proper way, that there is insufficient strength to assimilate the inner forces of external substances into the human organism. Let us assume this is too weak and is not developed with adequate intensity. In that case, you are not, as you should, introducing enough warmth into the organism via the eye. The head, developing only the declining graph of warmth, allows the body to grow too cold. This becomes apparent firstly at the extremities. So please observe now how the state of flagging energy derived from all I described today is intensified in such people, in symptoms of chilled hands and toes. This is very tangible, for you can feel here how the process that was accomplished in childhood from above downward through the image of the eye is not adequately met or countered with what needs to arise from and be developed by the active eye, which should carry warmth through into the furthest extremities of the limbs. This is something that will show you how, as soon as you see things in images, as soon as you take note of how the different powers above and below are subtly interacting, so that images arise, developing into something as fine and subtle as pictorial quality, then, in what comes to expression there, we really have what I would call images. In chilled hands and feet, you find images of what is occurring in the whole human organism. And then we can learn to assess the symptoms in a way that allows knowledge of the whole human being to leap out at us from them. If a person has chilled hands and feet, this is profoundly indicative of a failure of this I to engage properly in later life. If we take account of such things,
or if, in general, we simply engage with what spiritual science has to say, based on its fundamental approach, we can forge a real connection with the human organism. A failure to do this, to take account of such things, will gradually lead to a loss of connection and capacity to really perceive and understand the human organism. If we engage with what spiritual science has to offer, on the other hand, we acquire a connection with and insight into the human organism. We grow into it. Take the following example. This spiritual science continually stresses that there is something intrinsic in the power which enables us to stand upright, and that this power is in turn connected with the development of the eye from below upward. What first happens when we learn to raise ourselves upright expresses a power of uplift which is in a certain sense only external. It is supported by what streams down from above. Once the change of teeth has been completed, the power to raise ourselves has correspondingly used itself up. This primary power of uplift has come to a conclusion, and then the self-raising energy passes into our interior, where a balance must be created between what rises from below upward and what streams from above downward. And then the forces coming from above and those coming from below enter into mutual opposition, encounter each other. In this one-dimensional encounter, as I will call it, of the forces from above and those from below, we can see particularly well what is happening at this age. And now observe how people with, say, chlorosis or anemia grow very tired. They do not feel most tired when they walk on level ground, but when they're climbing stairs. This points us directly to these phenomena. People with a tendency to anemia are especially taxed by climbing stairs, and so in such symptoms, and in what comes to living expression as a child grows, we can grasp hold of spiritual realities underlying our existence. And then we can come to the point of simply reading off what we need to do to remedy abnormal conditions from what diagnostic pathology can tell us in this way. We will speak further of this tomorrow. The end of Lecture 4.